This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the first time.
So, last episode, you were feeling a little nervous about your very first hosting duties at an Author in Conversation event with Graeme Simsion. How did it go?
It was good. Maybe not great.
Not great? Why?
Well, it's sort of two things, and I think both are worth talking about. One is, I think it's called negative performance bias, and that's where you do some sort of panel or show or public kind of thing, and then you walk off and go, I should have said this, I should have said that.
Why rumination.
Rumination, exactly. So there's a possibility that there's a bit of negative performance bias, rumination, or maybe I just wasn't that great. No. I'll tell you what happened.
I want everyone to know that I was not here for this event, so I cannot give an independent...
Well, my mum said I was great. So Graeme got in touch the day before, 2 days before, and said, guess what? And I said, what? And he said, we've got an opening act.
Ooh.
And so this was, he had invited an actor who has autism to do like a performance piece opener.
Okay, great.
Which was great because a lot of the discussion were a fair amount of discussion. We were talking about different autism politics issues. So that was really good. But I was like, well, can you give me a bit more information? But he was like, not really. So that was fine. I knew that we'd have this intro piece happening. Then on the day, got to the bookshop and the person who was hosting the event was sick. So someone else was filling in.
Oh, okay. From the bookshop.
From the bookshop.
Okay.
So this meant that there wasn't really like a pre-meeting or anything, which I didn't really think about because I was chatting to people, doing all that sort of stuff. Graeme's amazing. He's signing people's books.
Yep. And very personable.
It's really good. Anyway, so then the session started and I, as the bookshop person was introducing, I sort of started realising that there were all these things that I hadn't really asked, like, was I meant to be introducing the opening act?
Okay, so in the structure of the thing.
Like, I hadn't really bedded that down at all. But she introduced the opening act, which was fine. And as the opening act was happening, I sort of said to her, you can introduce me or how will this work? But he ended up introducing Graeme and I, which was great. Then I didn't really know how to thank him, only in the sense that it needed contextualisation.
Sure, and which you knew Graeme was going to do.
Which I sort of thought Graeme was going to do, but then I was kind of hosting Graeme.
Which you'd already prepared, I see.
Which,
I see.
You know, so I didn't really do a thank you. So I just asked Graeme, I just sort of said thanks and asked Graeme his first question. And rather than respond to the first question, then Graeme is sort of did a much longer proper thank you. But it was just a bit of a weird start.
It puts you on the back foot when you're beginning, especially your first one.
Yeah. So it just felt like...
I can see that you've been ruminating on this. I feel like this is the therapy session.
It kind of is.
Yeah.
But the conversation was good. I guess we were divided a little bit in the things that we wanted to talk about maybe.
Because what do you...
Well, because I suppose a big theme for Graeme is autism, and probably half the people there were very interested in the politics of autism.
Yeah.
Whereas...
You wanted to talk about...
I was like looking at different connections between our works, I suppose. I did. Yeah. Anyway. So the other... much smaller problem was that Graeme had tweeted prior to the event saying, I'm going to be at this bar, you know, just before I go into this in conversation thing. And he copied me in on the tweet. And I wasn't going to go to the bar to have a drink beforehand. So I tweeted Graeme saying, can't wait to talk to you. I've got so many questions.
As you do. Like a,
well.
But you didn't.
Oh, well, I did have a lot of questions, but knowing that Graeme, because we've interviewed him on the podcast, knowing what a big talker he is, I had cut back all of the questions.
Oh, wow.
So I had like 8 questions.
Gold. They were gold questions. Really well thought out.
But there weren't many of them.
Okay. So
then Graham, after we did the intro, he asked, I asked him a question and he gave a very full answer. And I was like, this is so good. I've done the 8 questions, yeah. Like the really 8 really good questions. But then I asked the next question and he must have realized maybe that he did a very long answer. So on the knowledge that I had all of these questions, the question, he was less talkative, I felt. Maybe he wasn't less talkative.
Because he was waiting for you to get to the end of your 2 pages worth.
Pages worth of questions.
Insightful
which
questions.
I did not have at that point. So then I started panicking because we were going to finish in about 15 minutes and we were meant to be talking for much longer.
Sure.
Anyway, so we sort of padded it out a bit, but I did get quite desperate towards the end. I was asking for book recommendations. He very kindly recommended my book.
That's great. And I told you that you should do that because that's how it should happen. I feel like you have really kind of pulled this apart, analysed this at 3 a.m. in the morning, decided that you had this terribly shit experience. And maybe it wasn't that bad.
No, I've made it worse, definitely.
Yeah. Okay.
But also just that you realise how much of it is an interaction, isn't it?
It really is.
It
really is.
A conversation.
So in terms of that, you know, that's one thing you've thought of. Is there anything different you'll do the next time that you host one?
I would have the pre-meeting just confirming the...
Yeah, so it's like the green room chat.
Yeah,
what you would normally have if you were doing an event.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that find that person.
I would go in with a lot more questions. There's also a challenge to asking a question where you get a partial response. Do you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
You have this sort of theme you want to explore and that's that thing where they're sort of maybe not really interested in that theme or that question.
Yeah, which is that one ear on the convo, one ear on the sheet. You know, it's hard to nail
it's
that.
It's juggling.
It's juggling. Well, I am sure that you'll have some.
Oh, and then.
Oh, gosh.
Sorry. We take photos at the end. And Graham was like, go get your book. We'll hold up, you know, books.
Yeah.
And so we looked. We went to the shelf.
They didn't have your book.
And we looked for it wasn't in there.
No, that is bad form.
They must have had a rush on books.
They must have had a rush on it. But also that's bad form because I think part of the thing, and we know this as writers, but I don't know that everyone in the world knows this. We don't, like... There is no incentive to doing this gig
they did give me a voucher for
it. Oh, that's nice. Okay, yeah, so that was
that very
particular
nice.
Bookstore does.
Yes.
But normally, like, you don't get paid.
Which was very nice.
Maybe you get a card. And we do it for each other. Like, it's part of being part of the writing community. But sometimes I think people must think, like, we get paid for this gig. And you totally don't. And you've read a book. You've planned all the questions. You've got a night out.
Well, look,
at the very least, they should have your book in the bookstore.
I'm super flattered to be asked. But it was a sense of
flattery,
the disproportionateness between...
Bills.
Graham Simpson and me.
Have Catherine's book in store if you ask her to do things for you, please.
Well, enough about me. What's happening with you?
Okay. So this is the year of rejections, right? Remember
yeah,
how
you're
I was
clocking them up, I believe.
How I was planning for this, which is awesome. And I must admit, I haven't actually really got that many rejections yet, but I am waiting. I've got a whole lot of things out on submission.
Oh, God, waiting.
The waiting is unbearable. And I never really understood this because, and we've talked about it many times, but I had this like golden fairy tale of
it's
getting my first book published. And so I haven't done this part yet and I'm glad that I'm doing it now because I deserve to and every writer deserves to.
No,
but like I've had to turn the notifications sound off my emails, which I'd already done on my phone, but on my laptop too, because, you know, everyone that came in after I pressed submit,
that's awful.
I assumed was going to be, oh, come in for a meeting right now. Like we are going to sell this book everywhere, which of course doesn't happen. But I put it out on Twitter, like, people, how do I deal with this thing? And so there are a few different suggestions. One was Netflix, binge on Netflix while you're waiting. One was whiskey. I don't drink whiskey, but
the waiting
I could
can
learn.
Go for 12 months.
Well, it can go for a really long time. And I also am starting to realize because also when you start Googling, how long should I wait to email the agent I've queried? Everyone is on forums and there are many answers on Google because people obviously ask this question a lot.
What's the verdict?
Oh, you know, definitely for an agent in Australia, because I think in the US you can have multiple submissions out, whereas in Australia, yeah. I don't think that's really the done thing
I
with
don't
agents.
Know.
Well, look, I'm not doing it right now. just so you know, agents who are out there listening. So But 6 weeks. I'm going to do 6 weeks on that one before I email. I've got a lovely acknowledgement of receipt, and I understand it's a busy time of year.
It is.
She says, weeping and holding herself and rocking in the corner. The most important thing, though, that I did here on Twitter was start something new, which
you
slowly
I feel like
but
you get
surely.
A grace period, but then you have to start something
new. So I have done that. I was saying to you, too, and I think I've said this before, after doing Writing for Children last year as a subject at RMIT, I've got a couple of picture book manuscripts. And the beautiful thing about submitting and getting rejections for picture book manuscripts, which I have done, is that while there's an extraordinary amount of technique and love and ideas and all the rest of it and work and redrafting in a picture book, because they are about 500 words, it takes a lot less time than your 80,000 word novel. So being able to send out and then get very lovely kind of responses back, which are basically in picture books, not for our list at this point in time, but we love it. That it feels good. It feels like I'm doing some like kind of weights or something, you know, like I'm building that rejection muscle, and I'm also getting refining the pitch.
Are you refining the manuscript at all?
I have
a
couple of times, but mostly the feedback has just been, you know,
not for us.
We love it, but not for us. I'm right at this point. So there's nothing to really meaty to do it. Anyway, that's what I'm doing. But I wanted to ask you if you had waiting periods and can you remember what you did in them?
Yes. I remember sending, I won this small competition through the Gold Coast Writers Centre, and the prize was that Alan and Unwin would Alan Unwin picked the winner, but then as an additional random prize, they said that they would look at the manuscript. And I just took too long to send it to them. So by the time I sent it, I think they had gone cold. My contact there had gone cold. But the way that I worked that out was they'd never respond.
And that's the worst.
That's the hardest.
I actually think because I just had a little mini experience of that where, and I said to another writing friend, you know, I'm so glad I just got this email response because I had started to feel invisible. And that's how people must feel. And I just want to send such enormous love and solidarity to any of our listeners who are currently waiting on queries or submissions that are out there, because it is just...
I do also feel for the publishing editor. Like, I actually do legitimately feel for agents in that.
Absolutely.
I think Jacinta saying... she got sort of 100 submissions.
Absolutely.
It was like a phenomenal amount. So while on the one hand you're like, yes, this is someone's hopes and dreams, on the other, from a pragmatic logistical sense.
There's someone's hopes and dreams and there's 100 of them on your desk.
That's
plus there's the people you're employed to look after. And actually in the conversation coming up right after this with Davina Bell, she talks exactly about this being on the flip side, both as a writer, but then on the flip side as an editor and publisher as well. We need to ask our listeners, though, because we have started to have some listener questions come in to us.
Oh, I remember.
Yeah. So we thought we'd put it out there and maybe do a conversation coming up where we just respond to listener questions.
That'd be great.
Kind of about us within reason, you know, like about what we do.
So people should email us at hosts@thefirsttimepodcast.com.
This week, we speak with highly awarded children's author and editor, Davina Bell. Davina gives so much great advice about the children's book industry and writing for children in this interview. We suggest you get your pen out. Davina Bell is a writer for young people and a children's book editor. Her award-winning and notable picture books include All the Ways to Be Smart, Under the Love Umbrella, The Underwater Fancy Dress Parade, O Albert, and Hattie Helps Out. She is also the author of the Alice books in Penguin's best-selling Our Australian Girls series and the Lemonade Jones series. Also the author of a young adult novel that was shortlisted for the Text Prize and will be published in 2020. Davina's newest series for middle grade readers is Sophia and the Corner Park Clubhouse, which is out soon. Having been a senior editor at Penguin Books, she now works on the children's list at Affirm Press in Melbourne. Davina, welcome to The First Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I've cheated a little bit because I've heard you speak to my Writing for Children class before at RMIT, and I do have pages of notes from this. So I know you've got experience as a writer, as an editor, and kind of general all-round publishing guru. So much wisdom. I want to start with your experience as an editor because that's where you began, right?
Yeah.
Can you remember the first thing you ever edited?
The first thing I ever edited? Well, I think it was probably something for RMIT's Visible Ink magazine.
Visible Ink.
Visible Ink, where it all began. I think it was probably a short story for Visible Ink that I took very seriously. And from Visible Ink, which is the, should probably explain what it is, it's a committee of people curating a magazine of writing and putting it all together from the start of the process all the way to the end, and it's a really good learning experience. It was my first experience of being an editor. Yep. And from there, three of us started up our own little literary magazine called Harvest Magazine. Yes. So I think I really learned to be an editor on Harvest Magazine before I actually worked in publishing, because that was really, it was just us let loose to do whatever we wanted. And I think we took ourselves very seriously as editors.
As one should. What was it that kind of delighted you or excited you about the editing process?
I really love the collaboration of editing, and I love the idea that you can read in a smart way and then use that analysis to help someone make something stronger. I think I'd always loved reading as a child and as an adult, but I had never seen, I'd never really thought about it, being able to do it in a constructive way we are actually contributing to the world, because I didn't grow up in Melbourne. I didn't know anything about publishing until I moved here to do the course, actually, which I did to become a writer. And it was just this happy coincidence that I figured out I loved editing. I was a real word nerd, and just all these parts of my personality came together in this course, realizing that that could be a potential career. I'd really never thought about it growing up at all.
I love that. So you moved to Melbourne for the PWE course?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I grew up in Western Australia in Perth. I studied law there, and I was miserable and terrible at it. And when I got to the end of my degree, I thought, I cannot be a lawyer. I'd be such a bad lawyer. Pity the clients. What could I actually do with my life? And I thought, well, what am I passionate about? What do I love? All those cliche questions you ask yourself in a crisis.
Yep.
And had always been books and writing since I was a little kid. So my mum had actually cut out a newspaper article, as my parents are wont to do, about this course, about the RMIT course. And when I was moving out of my student house at the end of my law degree, I found that article in a box, and I applied on a whim and ended up changing literally my entire life.
That's fantastic. I love that story. And I should also mention, because Penny Johnson told me this recently, that there is someone who's just started the course this year, who has started the course because they were listening to this podcast. So shout out to that person. I'm not sure what your name is, but I'm so glad that you started RMIT at RMIT, because we've interviewed quite a number of writers who are alumni of the course.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I always say all the good things I have in my life came from doing this course. So, yeah.
So you came intending to be a writer.
Yes.
Editing came first. So where did writing come in to the process? What was the first thing you had published?
So I moved over with the idea that I would write a novel, a mystery novel set on a Jamaican rubber plantation. And I went to the first novel writing class, and I hadn't written anything creatively since I was about 12. Yeah. And I came to that first class, and everybody had very well thought out pitch ideas and manuscripts that they'd done six drafts on, and I was super intimidated. And when it came to my turn to explain what my novel was, I was very nervous, and I said, oh, it's a Jamaican rubber plantation mystery. And somebody said, are there even rubber plantations in Jamaica? And Olga, who is the very statuesque, Olga, commanding teacher, looked at me really quizzically like, who's this clown? And I promptly dropped out of the course.
Oh, my goodness.
And I enrolled in Anya's short story class. And then I realized I loved writing short stories. And the first story I wrote in that class got picked up by Sleeper's Almanac, and then it got selected for by Robert Drew for the Best Australian Stories collection of that year.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's a pretty impressive immediate kind of climb.
Well, I have to say it sent me into an existential crisis, because I thought, I peaked. I've done it now.
That's it. I mean, Best Australian Stories.
Like, I don't have any other stories in me. This is the end of my career. And so I was quite prone to an existential crisis at the time. And I didn't write, I entered something in the next year and had something in the next year. And then that really, I stopped writing after that for a really long period of time, until I was working at Penguin as an editor. And my publisher there read those stories and said, oh, have you ever thought about writing for children? Because both of those have links to children in them. And from there, that's how my first book came about, which was the Alice books in the Our Australian Girl series at Penguin, which is where I was working. So I feel like a bit of a cheat, because I was published where I was working, but in some ways, you almost have to be better than the average person to sneak in the back door, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. No, it really does make sense. That's so interesting. There's a couple of things in there that I want to touch on. First, in those first couple of years when you were submitting things to Sleepers, etc., did you have rejections in that time as well, or was it just... No, I didn't. I'm looking, just for our listeners, I want to explain the look on Davina's face right now, which is, oh, I'm about to tell you an answer you don't want to hear.
I am. No, I didn't have things rejected because, well, I really wrote so little. Like, those were just the thing, those two stories that were published were just the two stories that I wrote, which is very lucky.
Okay. 100%. I have strike right there.
But I have subsequently been rejected a number of times, if that's helpful to
the
listeners.
Great. That's good. That's balm for all of our souls.
Yeah.
And you hadn't thought about writing for children before this stage at all?
No, but while I was doing that law degree, I never went to class and I was a nanny and a babysitter and I worked with children with autism.
Okay.
And so my world was the world of the child. I was completely immersed in that. And that was sort of my escape from my horrible drudge of a law degree and hopeless future, not as a lawyer, that I didn't know what it would be. Because I don't know if your listeners would relate, but in Perth growing up, if you were an academic kind of kid, you either became a lawyer, a doctor, or an engineer. And I didn't think or know about any other professions.
Yeah, wow.
So I thought, I'm failing at being a law student. What am I going to do? And so to hide from that, I was around kids all the time and I found a lot of solace and comfort in that. So now when I look back, I think, of course I ended up writing for children because I spent half my 20s immersed with children and fascinated by children and interested in their development and their psychology and their relationships. So looking back, it's not a surprise at all.
It just sometimes takes a while to get to that perfect spot, I suppose, where all of your experiences come together.
Exactly. And then you look back and you think, oh, of course, sort of delightful inevitability.
Yes, yes, absolutely. As the ending of a picture book should be, I think I recall you saying in our class.
I feel like those words were familiar. I'm quoting myself.
You are quoting yourself. No, I love it. So those first books in the Our Australian Girls series, you were working to a kind of a deadline and B, a series that had already occurred. So how has that differed from your other creative endeavours in writing books?
That's such an interesting question and so funny because when I was writing those books, I was thinking longingly of the freedom of not being constrained by research and the tone and the form and the word count. And so then I started writing a novel that ended up becoming the young adult novel that was that's going to be published by Text.
Yeah.
But once I started writing that, it was sort of terrifying because there wasn't a structure and it changed so much over time from what it was and it became something really weird and wild and unconventional and it's told from two unreliable narrators and it goes back and forth in time and all around the world and it's about the internet and about love and sisters and it's so wild. It's almost like it's a kickback against having to have had those constraints of the first series that I wrote for. So I feel like it's a really different experience having a brief. But we were lucky at Penguin. We had to write with the Our Australian Girl series. We had to write historical fiction and we had to have a very specific tone. But apart from that, you could kind of shape the narratives in whatever way you wanted. And so it didn't feel... I know some authors who write for series are given literally an Excel spreadsheet with chapter one should be this, chapter two should be this. It wasn't like that at all.
Yep.
So the respect for narrative was really there and the author's own sort of interpretation of narrative and the editorial process is really strong, but it wasn't really kind of dictated to at all.
Yeah.
But I feel like my young adult novel is, it is so wild because of that kicking against that background, I'm pretty sure.
And then have you come to a kind of happy place in between in your writing now, or does it vary depending on the project?
I think because I write across age groups, so picture book, junior fiction, middle grade, YA, it's different every time and every project. So I feel like there's never a normal or a happy medium. It's sort of what you're immersed in at that time, if that makes sense. And sometimes things you need to put your own boundaries around things or, well, I feel like I'm a writer who responds well to structure. So if I can give myself a structure, I'm less likely to go off on tangents and down wrong rabbit holes. Also because I don't have a lot of time in my working life to write.
Yep.
So I need to be more efficient and effective. So I feel like if I have boundaries around what I'm aiming for, it actually makes it easier.
So do those boundaries include things like deadlines, word counts, etc., but also planning documents and the way you've planned out things beforehand?
Yes, all and both and all of those, except I, as any editor who has worked with me will attest, I always blow the deadline, even though I am an editor and I hate it when authors blow deadlines. I'm really bad at that just because I have so little time to write in my life. And also I'm a real optimist. I think, yes, of course I could do that by April the 23rd. And then realize, oh, well, you're actually in Perth for the Writers' Festival here and you're in Sydney doing something there. And you actually have books going to print that might need you to stay back late. So, I always play the deadline and I never stick to a plan. Actually, I'm sort of a nightmare author to work with. Apologies to my long-suffering editors who might be listening.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that too. How the editor Davina helps the writer Davina and vice versa. So you know, what have you learned as a writer from your work as an editor and back the other way, do you think?
That's a really interesting question because it is an interesting duality to have going on. I think as a writer, I've really watched how people who are open and flexible and collaborative just bring so much more joy to a project than people who are really stubborn and set in their ways and not willing to share a vision. So I think every writer's instinct is to be protective of their story and to own it as much as possible and to not want to give up things. I mean, it's just the perpetual story of being a writer, but to be open-minded and flexible and always willing to redraft and retry. And even just sometimes if I hate an idea, I'll sort of begrudgingly start writing it just to show how stupid it would be and then halfway through realize it was actually a really good idea.
Okay.
A really good structure to redraft. So I think as a writer, it's the flexibility and openness to collaboration.
Yeah.
And as an editor, I really just believe until you have actually written something yourself, you even if you are an editor who you're a creative, empathic kind of person who thinks that you understand the writing process and have watched it and observed it up close, you just can't know how much of yourself is in your writing until you've done that and how much it does feel personal in a way that from the outside it probably shouldn't. It should feel more rational, but it really does feel like a living piece of your heart outside your body. And I think as an editor, you can't quite understand how true and real that is unless you've been a writer, in my experience.
That's great. That says something. I feel like there should be some kind of collaborative project that Penny or Liz from RMIT should run for Australian editors where they do. Because is it for the Visible Ink subject at RMIT in editing where everyone has to write a piece and then they pass it around and everyone edits it, right? So maybe we make a new anthology of Australian editors' words.
That's actually a really good idea.
Let's do it.
And then you'll see how vulnerable you feel when that's out in the world.
So vulnerable.
Yeah.
That's great. I love that. I wanted to ask you, over that time since your first books came out, what's changed for you in the way that you manage both kind of practically and emotionally what happens when a book comes out into the world, one of your books comes out into the world?
Okay. So I would say from the experience of my first book, I really do believe if you're a person who has writing in your heart and that's something you've aspired to or dreamed about, there is literally nothing like seeing your first book come into the world. Just seeing it in a bookshop just feels like just wonder and magic beyond comprehension. And seeing a cover with your name on it, just I still remember the feeling and just feel I'm so inarticulate when I talk about it because it's such a visceral feeling in my chest, even when I remember that feeling now. And I do think, unfortunately, that I love every book that I'm a part of, but that first time is so magical that I don't think you can ever recapture that. So thinking as a writer at the start that it's going to change your entire life and from that point it's all going to be wonder, magical, sparkling joy.
All of it, right?
Eventually it's like when you shake up a snow dome and then it all just settles down again to the bottom and you realize, oh, I'm still the same person.
Yes.
Well, I still have the same problems. I still don't have a career in this.
It hasn't
and
fixed everything.
Yeah, exactly. So now I think I'm less emotionally swept up, I suppose, in the release of each book. And I think maybe as time goes on, because I work in publishing and I'm now so much more across book sales and how difficult it is for a book in the world, and I feel this protective apprehension for a book going out into the world that I didn't have at the start at all. I was so naive and blasé and just thought, well, what a wonderful thing. And I didn't feel responsible to the publisher about whether or not it sold, which I now really do. And back then there was no social media, so I didn't have to think about promoting it really. I think I remember putting a picture of it on my Instagram. It was like one of the first pictures ever on my Instagram because Instagram had just started. So I feel like nowadays it's a lot more about responsibility and what do I have to do next to support it, and poor little book, little tiny ship sailing into the world. Are you going to be okay? Oh gosh, it's so hard out there for you in the storm of the world. Which sounds really negative actually, but no, I still do feel a moment of wonder and joy just thinking this is real, and it started off just bouncing in my head. That magic never dies, and I don't think ever will. But it is definitely a different kettle of fish as time goes on, and I definitely do feel much more of a responsibility to the people who've taken the time and energy to invest in making that book and coming into the world as well.
What are the things, Davina, that a children's book needs to have at the moment to make it out there in the big bad world of many, many books?
Okay, I think we're really experiencing a shift at the moment in kids' books in terms of where they're stocked and how that shapes what kind of books are being made.
Yep.
I feel like people are much less able because the market's tightened, and that's got a lot of factors around it. For example, it sounds so weird, but in China, they're realizing they can get a lot more money for making eco-looking takeaway containers than selling paper to paper mills, selling product for paper mills to make paper. So the cost of paper's gone up heaps,
which means
it's more expensive to make a book, which means it's harder to make enough money to justify publishing a book. So just this way up the supply chain, it means it's harder to get a book off the ground. So that book has to have some kind of hook, has to be about an issue, or it has to be by a celebrity, or it has to address some kind of event like Christmas or Mother's Day or Father's Day or Easter, or it has to just look bedazzling.
Yeah.
And if a book, traditionally a book that we might have published that was more quiet or whimsical or thoughtful or less obvious or just wacky, the chances of getting that book out into the world are so much slimmer. So I feel like, are people just publishing more of certain types of more obvious books? And then the depth of what we're publishing as an industry is shrinking even as the volume grows, because people will tell you the statistics, oh, kids' books is where growth is at, that's what's happening. But you break those down, you look through the figures, it's the big names, it's Walliams, it's Treehouse Books, it's Arndoe. They're selling in huge quantities, but even though there are lots of books out there, the types of books are changing, I think. So I would say nowadays it's much more about the hook of a book. If that book can sell in the DDS, which are the discount department stores like Big W and Kmart and Target. And to do that, often it has to, I hate to say it and it feels so dirty, but if it's a book for girls, it has to be pink and sparkly. If it's a book for boys, it has to have a dinosaur on it, which just goes against everything that most people who work in publishing, progressive, educated people would actually believe. So you're constantly in a struggle against your values of what you want to create and put into the world, and the values you want to impart and what you want to say, versus justifying making a book and publishing an author's work and collaborating with an illustrator and giving them that commercial opportunity, and the compromises you have to make, which, you know, I fight against and consider and make decisions around almost every day of my publishing life.
Oh, it's so hard to hear all those things. And yet, but, so good to have the information.
But, can I also say?
Yes, go.
Every now and again, there is something pure and beautiful and whimsical that rises to the top. Like, for example, Affirm Press. Last year we had the CBCA Picture Book of the Year winner, Gwyn Perkins.
Yes.
He was 76 when he won. He just did this whimsical story about a grandpa and a cat walking through the bush, called A Walk in the Bush. And that didn't have an obvious hook. He was not a celebrity.
Yeah.
It was done in these sort of beautiful pastel colours and ink. There was nothing that said from the outside that that book was going to be a hit, and yet it just struck a chord.
And it did,
and it won an award, and it sold incredibly well, and it sells in Kmart and Target, and people pick it up and buy it and love it and share it. So that's what I want to say. There is still hope.
There is definitely hope. Keep writing those picture books.
And they are important, and I do believe the best ones still make it out into the world and rise to the top. It's just that the window is smaller for them to sneak through, if that makes sense.
And so to give our listeners some either further context in terms of, for instance, how many pitches you receive or a firm at the moment that you work for is receiving, what's coming in across your desk and your email kind of every week or every month?
In terms of volume?
Yeah.
I would say we probably get about 100 submissions a month, and that doesn't include... often we talk at conferences or at classes or different kind of pitching days. So it doesn't include those ones because we respond to those separately. So this is probably just unsolicited off the street ones. And then we also get submissions from agents as well. So it's a balance of all those things. But I would probably say at the moment, because we have opened our submissions up, it's probably about 75 to 100 a month.
And of those, how many would be published or picked up?
It's an interesting question. I would say per year, I would say probably between 3 and 5.
Yeah. Wow. So even if a whole lot of those are great pitches that are coming across your desk, there's only room for so many to be published.
Absolutely. And also because we're a tiny company, so our list, which we're expanding our list, but our list is limited just in terms of the resources that we have because there are only 3 of us. We're all part-time and we create all the books, whereas in a bigger publishing house, they've just got more capacity and more volume, but they also have a backlist that they're also working on at the same time, like repackaging and repurposing and keeping an eye on that as well. So each publishing house has its own constraints. But yeah, the space for new work is small. It really is. And you have to really head over heels, fall in love with something to justify and then be able to make the business case for it and be able to convince the sales director that it will sell.
And all the people.
Yeah, exactly. And hope that ASO take it on, who are Australian Standing Orders, who take orders for school libraries or Scholastic put it in their book catalogue or all those things that help boost up a print run that makes publishing the book worthwhile for everyone.
So many things to consider. And I will tell our listeners that I've already prepped Davina for this question, so I don't put her on the spot. But in the interest of being completely candid with our listeners, because I have told them previously that I was going to pitch a lot of things this year, I have pitched to Davina. She sent me a delightfully compassionate and thoughtful kind of a no. And she's going to, and I'm going to ask you, Davina, to tell me what did I do right in the pitch?
Yep.
And what other things are either outside of your control or what do I work on next time when I pitch?
Okay, so this is very interesting because what you did with me was an in-person, in-class pitch.
Yeah.
And I have to say, controversially, I don't think an in-class pitch is the best way to get work to an editor because at the end of the day, what I respond to is voice. Yes. For me, the thing about writing that I'm looking for is originality and freshness in the voice. And you can pitch, unless you can pitch that in, I've had one occasion where someone has pitched and I have heard that voice in the pitch and I signed up the book based on that.
That's really interesting.
Well, that was a picture book and it's really it's really much easier to do that with a picture book.
Yeah.
That happened at a writing workshop in Canberra. This accountant dad, Mitch Frost, pitched his picture book to me, The Ultimate Survival Guide to Monsters Under the Bed. And it was so charming in the way he framed it and the voice, just the voice of it was so strong. I said, oh, send it to me immediately. And I think he actually, I haven't confirmed this, but I wonder if he had actually written the whole thing at that point, but he ended up sending it to me. And I signed it up and it's just literally come back from the printers. And
that's so exciting.
That's one of the most thrilling moments as an editor is to be able to take it from that moment of just hearing about it and turn it into a book. But back to pitching, I feel like it's very, very, very difficult to convey what you're like as a writer in your pitch. So I can get a sense of you as a person and what you would be like to work with and how you see your book and how much you know about the market and how much you see about how your manuscript sits in that market, which is all great intelligence, but it comes down to the actual writing and how well suited that is to the genre that you're writing to the other things that we have on the list at that moment, if that makes sense, to the type of book we're looking for. So I would say your pitch really, your in-person pitch was fantastic and I really thought this is someone who knows their stuff and you had really thought about the premise, which was really intriguing and interesting and original, which was fantastic. I can't think of any feedback I give you about the pitch. It was more to do with the list and the writing and the voice and what you would need to work on in terms of tweaking those, if that makes sense. But I have a little problem with in-person pitching because I feel often writers are introverted people who spend a lot of time in their own heads and you're not best suited to being a salesperson for your work. Or in that moment of pitching, you come across like me with the Jamaican rubber plantation novel. You get overwhelmed and feel nervous and it comes across terribly.
Absolutely.
But I understand that because I am an author and I feel like it's not necessarily going to be the best performers who write the best. And at the end of the day, it comes down to what's on the page. And I feel like, oh, I'm jumping the gun. Can I do this, Kate?
Yes.
Can I give the advice to a debut author? Or
yes.
Do you want me to keep it
Yeah,
playing?
No. Give it now. Give it now.
I feel like you can get so caught up in how to pitch and your submission letter and what you should be doing with your social media and what other people around you are publishing or not publishing in your course or in your writer's group. And should you have a writer's group? Should you have an agent? What kind of advance should you accept? All these things go around in your head like a storm and it's all just time away from being in the chair and
so
just
is. You're
sitting
so right.
in the chair writing. That is what is going to make your writing stand out. That's going to make your writing stronger. And I equally am saying that to myself. As a published writer, forget all this mumbo jumbo about worrying about putting supportive comments on people's Instagram. Just go back to the chair, become a better author. That's your life's work. That's what's called you here for whatever reason that is inside of you. So maximize that. And if you're here on earth for such a short time, don't spend that time freaking out about whether or not you should have put a more charming anecdote in your submission letter. Like, that's not really, at the end of the day, going to make your writing stand out from the pile. Even though I love a charming story in a submission letter and it can help, it's not the be-all and end-all. I'm not hiring off that letter. I'm publishing off what your voice is saying to me from the page, what is springing out from your heart into my heart as a reader, basically.
That's so true. It's so true. And, you know, I was just, I was telling you before that I was teaching some grade 5-6 students creative writing this morning, and I was telling them, you know, writers will do anything to distract themselves from actually writing. Like, we will go down the Google hole to check what kind of historical detail we need, or we will, you know, do courses teaching us to how to be better authors before we've published anything. But actually what we need to be doing is bums in seats.
Because writing is hard and painful. It really is. And it sounds so stupid to say that, like, we're not in a war zone. We're not hoeing a field. But at the same time, it's a different kind of, it's because you're being so vulnerable, you're opening yourself up to some other channel working through you, it almost feels like. Like, I don't feel when I write, it's me in control of it at all. It's some other force that I'm trying to co-opt and craft, but you're kind of vulnerable to whatever that force is. And at the same time, you're constantly thinking it's going to be terrible. That's just the lot of a writer. And I would suggest that if you're not constantly thinking your writing is terrible, there's a higher chance it might actually be terrible. I think that self-doubt is inbuilt for a reason in a writer's constitution, and I think it serves us well a lot of the time. But pushing past that to the point where you get into that beautiful, magical flow where the world disappears and you write things that you read later and you think, I wrote that? Like, that actually came from my brain? That's just feels ridiculous and amazing. And I feel like marrying all those parts of yourself is why it is really difficult to just sit there and do it.
That self-doubt can be so paralyzing for writers. Do you think that your editorial experience gives you a harsher critic on the shoulder? Like, does it mean that the self-doubt rises up and smacks you in the face quicker, or can you process through it better?
No, seriously, it makes me such a harsher critic because I think you almost lose perspective. I think, am I as bad as half the people who send in unsolicited manuscripts off the street who think writing a kid's book so easy you can do it in an hour? Is this as bad as that? I don't know. How do I tell? So I think you really do doubt yourself a lot. The thing that has helped me, and I realize this is very fortunate in a way, is that now that I'm signed up for things that have deadlines in advance, I don't have as much time to indulge my inner critic. I just have to put it to the side because literally I have to bang out a manuscript by the next day or the next week or the next month. I don't have that time to work in a really a more thoughtful crafting kind of way. I literally need the words to be on the page and I just have to get them there somehow. So I feel like that's been much better for me as an author. I almost just don't have time to indulge that side of myself anymore. But I realize, A, not everyone's lucky enough to have that, and B, at whatever point where I stop having those deadlines, I know that's just going to come back roaring back into my life. So I've got to prepare myself for that.
But an interesting way to think about it too, even if people are self-imposing deadlines on themselves to say, I have to bang this thing out, rather than angsting
completely.
So much.
And I would say that's the best thing about doing a writing course or having a writer's group is having those external deadlines. Because when I was at RMIT, one of the main things I remember people saying is, while I was doing the course, oh, I wish I could have come back and done that course again, because when you don't have the external accountability, it's so easy to let it slide. And I remember thinking, oh, well, no, now I'm used to having deadlines. I'll just give myself deadlines all the time. But if you're like me, even a self-imposed deadline is just something to just sweep past and not even look in the rearview mirror at. It just is something, it's just meaningless to me. So unless I've got someone actually waiting for my work, and that could be your writing course, or it could be a friend who you've asked to read your manuscript, or your editor, or whoever, that for me is the only way to get past it. Because otherwise I will do anything to avoid writing, and I will just close my eyes and pretend the deadline's not happening.
Okay, external accountability, everyone. I found an interview that you'd done with Kids Book Review, and you were asked to describe yourself in 5 words, and you said, always willing to try again. And I wanted to ask, how important is being resilient when you're a writer and in the publishing industry in general?
I would say increasingly it's almost the most important skill. I would say in terms of working in publishing and getting a job in publishing, there are so many incredible, smart, talented, articulate, really well-read people with multiple degrees who can't get a job because they're the entry-level jobs, there are just so few of them. Our assistant editor at Affirm Press has way more degrees than I do. She's much better qualified, and yet it took her, I think, maybe 8 years to get a job. But that said, no, actually, there's nothing else to say. It's really hard and bad. But once you're in the industry, it's easier to move around, and people have babies and move publishing houses, and there are more opportunities than it seems like when you're first trying to crack into it. So I would say, I think I applied for maybe 30 jobs before I got my first editorial assistant job, which was at an educational publisher. So I would say resilience in terms of just putting your resume in everywhere, trying every different kind of job, if that's what you're passionate about. In terms of being a writer, yeah, I just think it applies to actually making the work. Mm. It applies to waiting to hear back from you, all the people who are looking at your work and assessing your work. It applies to getting reviews of your work that aren't good, or editorial feedback that is harsh. I actually paid someone for an editorial report of my YA manuscript because I thought, I can't tell if this is any good. It could be atrocious. It's a really weird manuscript. I'll pay someone who I respect. And I found that marked up manuscript the other day, and I actually can't believe that I ever wrote anything again after that. It was so harsh. Every page had things like, this is silly, boring, makes no sense, what? Like every single page. And I remember the feeling of reading it and feeling like, it was like a heartbroken feeling.
Yes.
Like it was like being broken up with. And I thought, oh, I'm embarrassing. I'm a failure. I thought I was writing this weird postmodern psychological thriller, and I've just written a whole sack of manure, and yet something in me didn't throw that away, and I ended up putting that marked up manuscript with all the feedback to the side, and that's the novel that I ended up entering into the text prize. But that's why I did it under a pseudonym, because I really didn't still know if it was as terrible as the feedback said or if there was something in it. So I would say, looking back, I can't believe I was as resilient with that piece of writing as I was. I don't know why I was, because looking back, it was crazy. But I feel like in all its forms, knowing that your work will be rejected, or it might not sell, or it might turn into something that you don't imagine, being persistent and resilient and, as I said before, open and collaborative, the combination of those things, I think, is really important. And I think I'm making it all sound like a bit of a downer. I'm really sorry. But
no, not at all. This is good.
This is kind of the realistic side, but the flip side of that is the magical side, and is just flipping through a book and seeing your words, or is that time at your desk where time disappears and you're just lost in the writing, or it's someone emailing you and saying, I read that book with my child and it's become sort of like our family dialogue or a talisman, or I sent my child to camp with it to give them comfort.
Oh, my goodness.
My husband and my daughter are reading your novels every night at bed, and here's a photo. Those moments are so magical, and you actually feel like there are so few chances in the world to make a difference. It feels like children's publishing is a space where you have the chance to shape the values and kind of shape the people. I always say the books you read when you're a kid shape the person you want to be, that kind of aspirational aspect of giving kids something to aspire to in the world. So I think all of those things are in their own way magical. I don't want it to sound like it's a desert landscape. It has many beautiful kind of jewels spread through it, but you just do have to be resilient in wading through all the barriers to get to those beautiful moments.
I want to ask a little, when we've had all our guests in, we've often talked about writers' festivals and being on the circuit and the rest of it. One of the wonderful things I know you get to do as a children's author is to visit schools and spend lots of time with kids. Mm-hmm. What do you like about that? What does that look like? How do you build it into your work life? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so talking in schools is... Oh, it's so, above all, I think it's really funny. It is really, there are just so many moments of just humour and pathos and things where I actually now have my writer's notebook with me at the front of the classroom when I'm giving a talk. So I give a PowerPoint and yep. It's often quite interactive. So I'm asking the kids questions and I always take in the first piece of writing I ever did that I thought that I had to present to the class. It's this really weird book called Aunt Millie Mocks the Dragon. And it's really terrible. Great. It's like a terrible story. And I talked to the kids afterwards, like, why is it a bad story? What about it would you change? How would you rewrite the ending? And they come up with all these different ideas. And honestly, the kids have such interesting, funny perspectives that I now have my writer's notebook at the front. And I'll say, look, this is a writer's notebook. If you are interested in being a writer, start your own. I think that's such a good idea. I'm going to write it down. And I just get these ideas from kids and things from their own lives, like their dog's name or that they have a funny chicken or some idea that happened when they were sleepwalking sometime or something like that. And I write them all down and you look back and it's such incredible material and just reminds you of kind of the breadth of a child's imaginative landscape and how restricted we are as adults in kind of the boundaries around how creative we are. It's just so wild and untamed. And I always say to kids, I teach writing to kids and adults, and who do you think has the best idea? And it's always the kids.
Yeah.
It's just that they don't quite know how to wrangle that into a structure, a form or a craft or whatever. But I really, the thing I love about school visits is the comedy, just the moments where they tell you funny things and the pathos, just seeing the things that land with them. Because often my books are about love or acceptance or knowing your own worth in the world, or they have some kind of bent in that direction.
Yeah.
And just seeing how they identify with that and are working through those ideas as I'm talking about them is really kind of touching and beautiful and feels meaningful. So the way that I balance it is I work 4 days as an editor and I work one day as a writer, and I'm lucky that my workplace is really flexible, so they let me switch it around. And then I take, if I have book week where it's talking in schools all week, I take my annual leave to do that, or I take leave without pay often as well. But keep in mind, you also, I'm also supposed to be doing the writing in between that, so it's almost like you have three jobs. It's the promoting your work and taking it to schools and festivals and all that sort of thing. It's the writing it, and then it's my editorial job as well. And then I would put in a fourth one here: emails. Oh my gosh, my whole life is emails. I suppose it's everyone's life, is it?
Yeah, maybe. But those different levels, I think, are so hard. Do you ever say, okay, that's it, nothing, I'm shutting myself in a turret somewhere and just writing because there's a deadline or because something else? Or can you write in the gaps?
I will often take off a chunk of time and say, those 4 days, I have to finish my manuscript by those days. And half the time that's successful and I get it done. And then the other half of the time I blow the time doing stupid admin tasks and I get to the end of the 4 days and have to beg more time from my editor. So I haven't quite figured out how to do it successfully. Anyone got any tips? I'm welcome to hear.
Are there predictions that you have about how the book industry might change over the next kind of 5 or 10 years, things that might be happening? You've talked about some of those way up the kind of chain changes that are happening that we can't control.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of things do you see ahead for us?
Okay, so I think more than any other time, we are hyper conscious of representation in our books. So representations of gender, race, sexuality, family constellations, neurodiversity, all those things, we are looking for those stories and those stories from people with that direct experience, sort of own voices stories. So I think there's just going to be a continual explosion of that. I really do think and hope that there is going to be a continuing change in the representation of gender in kids' books especially. I can see the start of it, and I think there's a market for parents who are hungry for it.
Yes.
I just feel like we need there needs to be some kind of pressure on publishers or on people stocking our books to say, no, these are viable books to create. It's not just pink books that are going to sell. Look, yeah, we'll prove it. There just needs to be some kind of takeoff series that really proves that, I think. So I feel that parents are more and more anxious about their kids spending time on screens and that they're looking for ways to build reading into the fabric of everyday family life. And I feel like that's a real opportunity in publishing to say, hey, your kid loves David Walliams. Now, instead of just going out and buying the next David Walliams, here are other things they could be interested in, and educating parents around the depth and breadth and interesting things that are being published. So yeah, I feel like hopefully if parents are more on board with broadening their habits as consumers of kids' books, and we can educate them and work with bookshops and booksellers or different kind of promotional reading opportunities. I really do believe, have you noticed that Book Week has just become this costume frenzy kind of situation?
As a parent of kids in primary school, yes, it is a costume frenzy situation.
Well, I feel like if we can harness even a quarter of the attention that people pay to their Book Week costume into what their kid's actually reading and could be reading next, that's a real opportunity,
total opportunity to
educate parents. So I feel like that's my deepest hope and wish, is that that's part of consumer habits we can all work together to, which will really strengthen the industry and strengthen the, and that means expanding the amount and type of books that we can publish. And I feel like that is going to be in ever more in response to parents feeling anxious about screens and their effects, and that more research will come up about that, and hopefully there'll be a bit of a swing back. And the other thing I think potentially is going to happen is, as the world globalizes more, I can see a hunger more among schools, but maybe also teachers and families, for more Australian content that does reflect our everyday lives and experiences. And I think that's why I mentioned Gwyn Perkins' book, A Walk in the Bush. I think that did so well because at some level, Australian parents do have this longing for their kids to connect with the nature of the bush. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's mythology, or maybe it's really a longing to be more connected to landscape. So I feel like beautiful representations of Australian life and wildlife and landscape that aren't like Aussie Santa surfing or those more obvious representations are going to find a place in the market. That is also what I'm predicting as well, based on nothing.
Excellent. I love these predictions. We will come back and see them. Now, a quick aside, just because I find it so interesting, your very excellent website, which people should go and check out, and we'll put a link in our show notes, you sell your books on there.
Yes, I do. Yes.
Tell me how this works. It seems so smart. Is it a lot of trouble and time? Tell me everything about this concept.
Mate, if I had a dollar for every hour I've spent in line at the North Fitzroy post office wishing I wasn't there, it's one of those things where it seems like such a good idea, and it sort of is, but I don't charge enough postage because I feel not a commercially minded person, and I feel bad being like, oh, $10 postage for a $25 book. That seems crazy. I'll make the postage $5. So I'm paying a gap in the postage just because I'm a stupid business person. And then I like to wrap up the books in a certain way, which maybe it's a procrastinating thing from doing writing, not taking my own advice, but I wrap the books in a certain way, and then I want to make sure they're not going to get mashed in the envelope, so then I fork out for a more expensive padded envelope.
Oh, Davina.
And then I think, oh, I should write them a personalised note. And then often, then I have to go to the post office, and then I often put that off because there's always a line, or I'm going to get in an endless conversation about which is the best, most efficient way to send it. But then I really do believe in it, because if people want a signed message, I feel like that's a nice way for them to get it, especially people in rural areas who can't come to a signing or a festival.
Great.
Or something. So
okay,
I often talk in schools in rural areas, and that's one of the reasons I do the online book sales, is because I know these kids, they don't have a bookshop within 3 hours. Like, the nearest is Big W 3 hours away. And I felt like that seems wrong to me. So hopefully, and some of my sales are from people in country areas. Is it worth it? Look, at the end of the day, probably not. And it's sort of one of those false things where money lands in your account and you're like, woohoo, $90 extra. And then by the time you've paid for the postage, yes, and the time and all those things, maybe it's not worth it. But I am going to keep doing it. I just do feel like it's a way to connect with readers. And I just feel like giving that option for people who don't have access to bookstores is a nice thing to do. And often if you're able, people say, can you sign this for a new baby? Or can you sign this for my daughter's starting kinder? Just getting those little personal stories of your readers. You're so disconnected as an author from where your books end up, really.
Yeah.
So I guess it's a way to maintain and cultivate those connections, and then just to know that you're part of, it's actual people buying your books. I think it's a good reminder of that. So probably silly business, but in some ways heartening on a personal level.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. You've given us your advice, really, that you want to pass on to debut authors. I do want to ask you, because I think our listeners will come at me on Twitter if I don't. What do you want to see come across your desk as Davina, the editor? Like, voice, you've already told us you want this really strong voice. In a fantasy world, what comes across your desk next week that you are lit up by?
Well, on a personal level, editorially, my big passion is standalone middle fiction.
Yep.
So for me, that most incredible thing would be a really original, beautifully written, funny, heartfelt Australian middle grade fiction, because I think that's an area that the US does fantastically well. If you look at Rebecca Stead or Kate DeCamillo or RJ Palacio, who did Wanda, I still don't think we've quite got to that level yet in Australian middle grade fiction. So I feel that would be my absolute dream, to see more of those kind of books.
Yeah.
But really, I just think my philosophy as an editor is that I'm either looking for books that are going to give kids comfort, wonder, or joy, or some consolation of those three things. So anything that I feel like does that in an original way that feels like I haven't read it 1,000 times before, and that really it's almost speaking through a child's perspective, not to a child. I think that's probably the biggest mistake that writers for children make, is that they're thinking about telling a story to a child rather than looking at the world through a kid's eyes. And so something that really feels like it has that authentic voice and child perspective always lights me up. And then just, it just makes me feel so heartened when people who clearly are talented writers see the value and worth in writing for children as opposed to adults. Just people who are stylish, beautiful, understated writers, seeing them write for children, I think, is a huge joy as well. So that would probably be my dream. But I really do think it comes back to comfort, wonder, and joy. And maybe that's a book that's really funny, that's bringing joy, or a book that brings comfort in the emotional landscape of the book, or that brings wonder in thinking about something incredible that happened in the past. Or you can interpret that in a million ways, but that at its essence, that's always what I am looking for.
Such great notes. I'm going to re-listen to this many times and take notes. Before I let you go, I want to ask you if you can please recommend a debut book to us and our listeners.
Can it be one that hasn't come out yet?
It certainly can.
Oh, okay. So all the things I was just saying about middle grade fiction,
yep.
I realised I'm editing that book at the moment.
Amazing.
It's already come across my desk.
Brilliant.
It's Fiona Hardy's debut novel. It's a middle grade one called How to Make a Movie in 12 Days. And it is Australian. It's contemporary. It's funny. The relationships and the friendships are so real. And it's about a girl whose grandma dies and she inherits the money to make to buy a movie camera, like a professional camera, that means she can finally make this movie she's been planning her whole life. And then someone starts to sabotage the movie. And it's about her dealing with the grief of her grandma. And it's a really, such a real, believable Australian family, and the relationships with her elder brother and her really funny, dark younger sister. And the dad's a stay-at-home dad and her mum is a working mum, but is coping with the kind of judgment she feels for that. So it's really rich in its landscape of family and emotions, but it's so light and funny, and it's such a rare combination of things. So Fiona Hardy's debut novel, How to Make a Movie in 12 Days, it is coming out in September in time for Christmas. And look out for it and give it to all the kids in your life. It's just such a beautiful example of a really talented writer writing something that is uplifting and wonderful, but also rich and in places tear-jerking and just so incredibly relatable, I think, as well.
Sounds wonderful. We will definitely look out for it. Davina, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us on The First Time.
Thank you so much. And this is actually my first time doing a podcast. And thank you for the wonderful questions and for the lovely atmosphere that made it so enjoyable to talk about all these things that I'm so passionate about. So thanks so much also for having a kids author, because I know sometimes it's the adult authors you get all the spotlight. So really appreciate it.
Thank you. If you'd like more information about Davina Bell or any of the things we spoke about in today's episode, you can go to the show notes at thefirsttimepodcast.com and follow the links there. Also, you can get in touch with us via Twitter or Instagram at thefirsttimepod and let us know what you thought of the episode. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe 80. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.